will already have taken place before communication can resolve it. Xu Qiang took a drag on his cigarette, and his contemplative face emerged from the darkness for a moment.
It looks now like the Battle of Darkness has a lot to teach us.
That's right. The five ships of Starship Earth formed a quasi-cosmic civilization, not a real one, because they consisted of a single species, humans, who were very close to each other. But even so, when they were dealt that dead hand, the chain of suspicion emerged. In actual cosmic civilization, the biological differences between different groups might be as high as the kingdom level, and cultural differences are even further beyond our imagining. Add to this the vast distances between them, and you have chains of suspicion that are practically indestructible.
That means that the outcome is the same, regardless of whether we're benevolent civilizations or malicious civilizations.
That's right. That's the most important aspect of the chain of suspicion. It's unrelated to the civilization's own morality and social structure. It's enough to think of every civilization as the points at the end of a chain. Regardless of whether civilizations are internally benevolent or malicious, when they enter the web formed by chains of suspicion, they're all identical.
But if you're much weaker than I am, you're not a threat to me. So I could always communicate with you, right?
That won't work either. Here we need to introduce a second important concept, the technological explosion. I didn't get a full explanation for this either, but it was far easier to infer than the chain of suspicion. Human civilization has 5,000 years of history, and life on Earth might be as much as a few billion years old. But modern technology was developed over the course of 300 years. On the scale of the universe, that's not development. It's an explosion. The potential for technological leaps is the explosive buried within every civilization, and if it's lit by some internal or external factor, it goes off with a bang. On Earth, it took 300 years, but there's no reason why humanity should be the fastest of all cosmic civilizations. Maybe there are others whose technological explosions were even more sudden. I'm weaker than you, but once I've received your message and know of your existence, the chain of suspicion is established between us. If at any time I experience a technological explosion that suddenly puts me far ahead of you, then I'm stronger than you. On the scale of the universe, several hundred years is the snap of a finger. And it might be that my knowledge of your existence and the information I received from our communication was the perfect spark to set off that explosion. That means that even though I'm just a newborn or growing civilization, I'm still a big danger to you. Xu Qiang watched Luoji's flame in the darkness as he thought for a few seconds, then looked at his own cigarette.
So I have to keep quiet.
Do you think that will work?
They smoked. The balls of flame brightened, and their faces emerged from the darkness like the gods of this simple universe, deep in thought.
Xu Qiang said,
No, it won't. If you're stronger than me, then since I was able to find you, one day you'll be able to find me, and then there will be a chain of suspicion between us. If you're weaker than me, you could experience a technological explosion at any time, and that would take us back to the first case. To sum up, 1, letting you know I exist, and 2, letting you continue to exist, are both dangerous to me and violate the first axiom.
Da Shi, you've really got a clear mind.
My brain can keep up with yours so far. But we're only getting started.
Luoji was silent in the dark for a long time. His face emerged in the weak light of the ball of flame 2 or 3 times before he said,
Da Shi, this isn't a start. Our reasoning has already reached a conclusion. Conclusion? We haven't figured anything out. Where's the picture of cosmic civilization you promised?
If neither communication nor silence will work once you learn of my existence, you're left with just one option. In the long silence that followed, the two flames went out. There was no wind, and the dark silence turned thick as asphalt, connecting sky and desert into a murky hole. At last, Shi Qiang uttered one word in the darkness.
Fuck.
Extrapolate that option out to the billions upon billions of stars and hundreds of millions of civilizations, and there's your picture, Luoji said, nodding in the darkness.
That's really dark.
The real universe is just that black. Luoji waved a hand, feeling the darkness as if stroking velvet. The universe is a dark forest. Every civilization is an armed hunter, stalking through the trees like a ghost, gently pushing aside branches that block the path, and trying to tread without sound. Even breathing is done with care. The hunter has to be careful, because everywhere in the forest are stealthy hunters like him. If he finds other life, another hunter, an angel or a demon, a delicate infant or a tottering old man, fairy or a demigod, there's only one thing he can do. Open fire and eliminate them. In this forest, hell is other people, an eternal threat that any life that exposes its own existence will be swiftly wiped out. This is the picture of cosmic civilization. It's the explanation for the Fermi paradox. Shi Qiang lit another cigarette, if only to have a bit of light. But in this dark forest, there's a stupid child called humanity, who has built a bonfire and is standing beside it shouting, "Here I am! Here I am!" Luoji said.
Has anyone heard it?
That's guaranteed. But those shouts alone can't be used to determine the child's location. Humanity has not yet transmitted information about the exact position of Earth and the solar system into the universe. From the information that has been sent out, all that can be learned is the distance between Earth and Trisolaris, and their general heading in the Milky Way. The precise location of the two worlds is still a mystery. Since we are located in the wilderness of the periphery of the galaxy, we're a little safer.
So what's the deal with the spell?
Using the sun, I transmitted 3 images to the cosmos. Each one consisted of 30 points representing the planar projection of a 3-dimensional coordinate system containing the position of 30 stars. Combining the 3 images into 3-dimensional coordinates forms a cubic space populated by those 30 points. That represents the relative positions of 187J3X1 and its 29 surrounding stars. There's also a label pointing out 187J3X1. Think about it carefully and you'll get it. A hunter in a dark forest, stalking with bated breath, suddenly notices that a piece of bark has been stripped from a tree in front of him. On the eye-catching bit of white wood that's been revealed is a position in the forest, written in characters all hunters can recognize. What will he think about that location? He's certainly not going to imagine that someone has laid out supplies for him there. Out of all the possibilities, the most likely one is that the blaze is informing everyone that there's live prey at that location that needs to be eliminated. It doesn't matter what motivated someone to leave the mark. What's important is that the dead hand has stretched the nerves of the dark forest to the breaking point, and it's the most sensitive nerve that's most liable to make a move. Suppose there are 1 million hunters in the forest. The number of civilizations on the billions upon billions of stars in the Milky Way could be thousands of times that. Perhaps 900,000 of them will disregard the marking. Of the remaining 100,000, Maybe 90,000 of them will probe the location, and after confirming that it has no life, disregard it. But one of the remaining 10,000 hunters will surely make a choice to fire on that position, because for civilizations at a certain level of technological development, attacking may be safer and less of a hassle than probing. If there's really nothing at that location, then it's no loss. Now, Luoji concluded, that hunter has appeared.
That spell of yours can't be sent anymore, right?
That's right, Dashi. The spell needs to be broadcast to the entire galaxy, but the sun's been locked down, so it can't be sent anymore.
Was humanity just a step late?
Shi Qiang flicked aside his cigarette end. The flame drew an arc through the darkness as it fell, momentarily illuminating a small circle of sandy ground.
No. No. Think about it. If the sun hadn't been sealed off, and I had threatened Tri-Solaris with sending out a spell against them, what would have happened?
You would have been stoned to death like Rey Diaz, and then they would have enacted legislation to prohibit anyone else from thinking along those lines.
That's right, Dashi. Because we've already revealed the distance between the solar system and Tri-Solaris, as well as our general heading in the Milky Way, exposing the location of Tri-Solaris is tantamount to exposing the location of the solar system. That's a death strategy. Maybe we're a step late, but it's a step that humanity would never be able to take.
You should have threatened Tri-Solaris back then.
Things were too weird. I wasn't certain about the idea at the time, so I needed to confirm it. After all, there was plenty of time. But the real reason was that, deep in my heart, I really didn't have the mental strength. I don't think anyone else would either.
Thinking about it now, we shouldn't have gone to see the mayor today. This situation, if the world learns about it, then it's even more hopeless. Think about how the first two wall facers ended up.
You're right. The same thing would happen to me, so I hope that neither of us says anything. But you still can if you want. Like someone once told me, either way, I've fulfilled my duty.
Don't worry, my boy. I won't say anything.
Regardless, there's no longer any hope. They walked along the embankment and to the highway, where it was slightly less dark. The sparse lights of the residential area in the distance were enough to blind them.
There's one more thing. That person you mentioned?
Luoji hesitated. Forget it. All you need to know is that the axioms of cosmic civilization and the theory of the dark forest were not my invention.
Tomorrow, I'm going into the city to work with the government. If you need any help in the future, just say the word.
Dashi, you've helped me more than enough. I'll head into the city tomorrow too, to the Hibernation Immigration Bureau, to take care of waking up my family. Contrary to Luoji's expectations, the Hibernation Immigration Bureau said that reawakening Zhuangyan and Xiaxia was still blocked, and the Bureau's director made it clear to him that his wall-facer powers were ineffective in this regard. He consulted Hines and Jonathan, who were unacquainted with the details of the situation, but they told him that the revised Wall-Facer Act contained a provision stating that the UN and Wall-Facer Project Commission could take all necessary steps to ensure that the Wall-Facer remained focused on his work. Which meant that, after 2 centuries, the UN was once again using Luoji's situation as a tool to coerce and control him. Luoji requested that his hibernator settlement remain in its current state and be kept free of outside harassment. This request was faithfully executed. The news media and the masses of pilgrims were kept at a distance, and after calm was restored throughout New Life Village No. 5, it was like nothing at all had happened. 2 days later, Luoji attended the first hearing of the revived Wallfacer project. He didn't go to the underground UN headquarters in North America, but attended by video link from his Spartan residence in New Life Village No. 5, where scenes from the assembly appeared on the ordinary television in his room.
Wallfacer Luoji, we were prepared to face your anger,
the commission chair said. My heart has been burnt to ash. It no longer has the capacity for anger, Luoji said, reclining lazily on the sofa. The chair nodded.
That's a wonderful attitude. However, the commission feels you ought to leave your village. That little place isn't a worthy command center for the defense of the solar system.
Do you know about Xi Bai Po? It's an even smaller village not far from here. Over 2 centuries ago, that's where our nation's founders commanded one of the largest offensives in history. The chair shook his head.
Clearly you haven't changed at all. Very well. The commission respects your habits and choices. You should get to work. It's not going to be like back then, with you claiming that you're always at work, is it?
I can't work. The conditions for my work no longer exist. Can you harness stellar power to broadcast my spell into the universe? The representative of the Asian fleet said,
You know that's impossible. The droplet's radio suppression of the sun is continuous, and we don't anticipate that it will stop for the next 2 or 3 years, by which time the 9 other droplets will have reached the solar system.
Then there's nothing I can do. The chair said,
No, Wallfacer Luoji. There's one important thing you haven't done. You haven't disclosed the secret of the spell to the UN and SFJC. How did you use it to destroy a star?
I can't tell you that.
And if it were a condition for reawakening your wife and child?
That's a despicable thing to say at a time like this.
This is a secret hearing. Besides, the Wallfacer Project doesn't have any place in modern society. The revival of the Wallfacer Project means that all decisions made by the UN's Wallfacer Project Commission 2 centuries ago are still in effect. And according to those resolutions, Zhuangyan and your child would reawaken at the Doomsday Battle.
Didn't we just fight the Doomsday Battle?
The 2 internationals don't think so, since the main Trisolaran fleet has yet to arrive.
Keeping the secret of the spell is my responsibility as a Wallfacer. Otherwise, humanity will lose its last hope, though that hope may already be gone. In the days following the hearing, Luoji stayed inside, drinking heavily, and spent most of his time in a state of intoxication. People occasionally saw him emerge, with his clothes disheveled and his beard long. He looked like a tramp. When the next Wallfacer Project hearing was convened, Luoji again attended from home.
Wallfacer Luoji, your condition has us worried,
the chair said when he saw Luoji's unkempt appearance in the video. He directed the camera around Luoji's room, and the assembly could see that it was littered with bottles.
You ought to get to work, if only to restore yourself to a normal state of mind,
the representative of the European Commonwealth said. You know what will return me to normal.
The reawakening of your wife and child really isn't all that important, the chair said. We don't want to use that to control you. We know that we can't control you. But it's a resolution made by the previous commission, so addressing the issue presents some difficulties. Bottom line, there must be a condition.
I reject your condition.
No, no, Dr. Luo. The condition has changed.
At the chair's words, Luoji's eyes lit up, and he sat up straight on the sofa. And now the condition is?
It's simple. Couldn't be simpler. You just have to do something.
If I can't send a spell out into the universe, there's nothing I can do.
You have to think of something to do.
You mean, it could be something meaningless?
So long as it looks significant to the public,
In their eyes, you're either the spokesman of the force of cosmic justice or a heaven-sent angel of justice. At the very least, these identities can be used to stabilize the situation. But if you do nothing, you'll lose the faith of the public after a while.
Achieving stability that way is dangerous. It'll lead to no end of trouble.
But what we need right now is to stabilize the global situation. The 9 droplets are coming to the solar system in 3 years, and we have to be prepared to deal with that.
I really don't want to waste resources.
In that case, the Commission will provide you with a task, one that won't waste resources. I'll ask the chairman of the SFJC to explain it to you.
The chair said, as he gestured to the SFJC chairman, who was also attending via video. The SFJC chairman was evidently in some space-based structure, because the stars were shifting slowly across the broad window behind him. He said,
"Our estimate of the arrival of the 9 droplets in the solar system is based entirely on speed and acceleration estimates obtained when they crossed the first interstellar dust cloud 4 years ago. They differ from the one that's already here in that their engines operate without emitting light. They don't emit any other high-frequency electromagnetic radiation that could provide a position. This is likely a self-adjustment made after humanity successfully tracked the first droplet. Locating and tracking such small, dark bodies in outer space is incredibly difficult, and now that we've lost their tracks, we don't know when they'll reach the solar system. We don't even know how to detect that they've arrived."
"So what can I do?" Luoji asked.
"We hope that you can lead the Snow Project."
"What's that?"
"Using stellar hydrogen bombs and Neptune's oil film, we will manufacture clouds of space dust that the droplets will leave tracks in when they pass through."
"You've got to be joking. You do realize that I'm not entirely ignorant about space."
"You were an astronomer once. That makes you even more qualified to lead this project."
"Making a dust cloud was successful last time because the approximate path of the target was known. But now we know nothing. If the 9 droplets accelerate or change course while dark, then they might even enter the solar system from another side altogether. Where are you going to spread the dust cloud?"
"In every direction."
"You mean to say that you're going to manufacture a ball of dust to envelop the entire solar system? If that's the case, then you're the one who's been sent by God."
"A ball of dust is impossible, but we can make a ring of dust on the ecliptic plane, between the asteroid belt and Jupiter."
"But what if the droplets enter outside the ecliptic plane?"
"That can't be helped. But from an astrodynamics perspective, if the droplet group wants to encounter every planet in the solar system, then the greatest likelihood is entry on the ecliptic plane. That's what the first droplet did. That way, the dust cloud will be able to capture their tracks, and, once captured, the solar system's optical tracking system will be able to lock onto them."
"But what's the point of that?"
"We'll at least know that the droplet group has entered the solar system. They might strike civilian targets in space, so all ships will need to be recalled, or at least those in the droplet's path. And the inhabitants of space cities will have to be evacuated to Earth, because those are weak targets."
"There's another matter that's even more critical," the Wallfacer Project Commission chair said. "Identifying safe routes for the possible withdrawal of spacecraft into deep space."
"Withdrawal into deep space? We're not talking about escapism, are we?"
"If you must use that name."
"Why not begin the escape now?"
"Present political conditions do not permit it. But when the droplet group approaches Earth, a limited-scale flight might become acceptable to the international community. Of course, it's only a possibility. But the UN and the fleets must make preparations for it."
"I understand. But the Snow Project doesn't really require me."
"It does. Even inside the orbit of Jupiter, creating a dust cloud is an enormous undertaking and will require the deployment of almost 10,000 stellar hydrogen bombs,
more than 10 million tons of oil film, and the formation of an enormous space fleet. To accomplish that within 3 years requires taking advantage of your current status and prestige to organize and coordinate the resources of the two internationals.
If I agree to undertake this mission, when will you wake them?
Once the project is started. Like I said, it won't be a problem.
But the snow project never got fully off the ground. The two internationals were not interested in the project. What the public wanted was a strategy for global salvation, not a plan that would merely inform them of the enemy's arrival so they could escape. Besides, they knew that this wasn't the wall-facers' idea. It was just a plan implemented by the UN and SFJC that exploited his authority. A full launch of the Snow Project would bring the entire space economy to a standstill and lead to a general economic recession on Earth and in the fleet. In addition, contrary to the UN's prediction, as the droplets drew nearer, escapism turned even more repugnant in the eyes of the public, so the two internationals were unwilling to pay such a high price for an unpopular plan. As a result, both the construction of a fleet to gather the oil film material on Neptune and the manufacture of sufficient stellar hydrogen bombs to supplement the fewer than 1,000 from the Great Ravine that were still usable made very slow progress. But Luoji poured himself entirely into the project. At first, the UN and the SFJC had only wanted to exploit his prestige to mobilize the resources needed, but Luoji immersed himself in every detail of the project, spending sleepless nights shoulder to shoulder with the scientists and engineers of the technical committee and proposing many of his own ideas. For example, he suggested that a small interstellar ion engine be installed onto each bomb to allow them a certain degree of mobility in orbit, enabling timely adjustments to the density of the stellar cloud in different regions. More importantly, the hydrogen bombs could act as attack weapons. He called them space mines, and argued that even though stellar hydrogen bombs had proven incapable of destroying droplets, they might in the long run be useful against Trisolaran ships, because they had no evidence that the ships were also constructed out of strong interaction material. He personally determined the orbit for every bomb's deployment. From a modern technological perspective, his ideas may have been full of a 21st century ignorance and naivete, but his prestige and wall-facer status meant that most of his suggestions were adopted. Luoji treated the Snow Project as a means of escape. He knew that he wanted to escape reality, and the best way to do that at present was to involve himself deeply in the project. But the more he devoted himself to it, the more disappointed in him the world became. Everyone knew he had only attached himself to the largely insignificant project so that he could see his wife and child as soon as possible. The world waited for a plan for salvation that never materialized. Luoji declared over and over in the media that without the capability to use stellar power to send out a spell, he was powerless to do anything. The Snow Project ground to a halt after a year and a half, at which time only 1.5 million tons of oil film had been collected from Neptune. Even adding the 600,000 tons collected for the fog umbrella, the figure was still far from what the project required. Ultimately, 3,614 stellar hydrogen bombs packed in oil film were deployed in an orbit 2 AU from the Sun. This wasn't even a fifth of the intended number. When detonated, they would form a large number of independent dust clouds orbiting the Sun, rather than a continuous dust cloud belt, greatly reducing their effectiveness as a warning. It was an age in which hope came as quickly as disappointment, and after anxiously waiting for a year and a half, the public lost faith and patience in Luoji the Wallfacer. At the general meeting of the International Astronomical Union, a body that last attracted worldwide attention in 2006 when it revoked Pluto's eligibility as a planet, a large number of astronomers and astrophysicists were of the opinion that the explosion of 187J3X1 was a chance occurrence. Being an astronomer, Luoji may have discovered certain signs that the star would explode. The theory was full of holes, but more and more people came to believe it, accelerating Luoji's decline in prestige. In the eyes of the public, his image gradually transitioned from messiah to commoner, and then to fraud. He still enjoyed the wall-facer status granted by the UN, and the Wall-Facer Act was still in effect, but he no longer had real power. Year 208, Crisis Era. Distance of the Trisolaran Fleet from the Solar System, 2.07 light-years. On a cold, drizzly autumn afternoon, a meeting of the New Life Village No. 5 Residence Council came to the following decision. Luoji would be expelled from the neighborhood on the grounds that he was affecting the normal life of the neighborhood's residents. While the snow project was in progress, Luoji had frequently gone out to attend meetings, but the majority of his time was still spent in the area, and he kept in contact with various snow project entities from home. Disruptions had only worsened as his position declined, since from time to time, crowds of people would gather at the foot of his building to jeer him or throw stones at his window. Media interest in the spectacle was enough to make reporters as numerous as protesters. But the real reason for Luoji's expulsion was that he was an utter disappointment to the hibernators. When the meeting adjourned that evening, the neighborhood committee director went to Luoji's home to inform him of the council's decision. After pressing the doorbell repeatedly, she pushed open the unlatched door and practically choked on the mix of alcohol, smoke, and sweat that filled the room. She noticed that the walls had been converted into city-style information surfaces that allowed information screens to be called up anywhere with just a tap. A confusion of images filled the walls, most of them displaying complex data and curves, but the largest showing a sphere suspended in space. A stellar hydrogen bomb packed in oil film. The transparent film with the bomb clearly visible within it reminded the director of a marble, the sort of thing children liked to play with back in Luoji's day. It rotated slowly. There was a small protrusion at one pole, the ion engine, and in the sphere's smooth surface was the reflection of a tiny sun. All of those dazzling screens turned the room into a huge, gaudy box. Since the lights were off, they were the only source of illumination, dissolving everything into blurry color so that it was hard at first to distinguish what was a physical presence and what was just an image. Once the director's eyes had adapted, she saw that the place looked like the basement of a drug addict, the floor littered with bottles and cigarette ends, the piles of clothes covered in ash like a garbage heap. She eventually managed to locate Luoji among the garbage. He was curled up in a corner, black against the backdrop of the images, like a withered branch that had been cast aside. She thought he was asleep at first, but then noticed that his sightless gaze was fixed on the piles of garbage on the ground. His eyes were bloodshot, his face haggard, his body gaunt, and he seemed unable to support his own weight. When he heard the director, he greeted her and turned toward her slowly, then just as slowly nodded at her, so that she knew he was still alive. But the 2 centuries of torment that had accumulated in his body had now completely overwhelmed him. The director didn't show the slightest bit of mercy toward this man who had been totally used up. Like other people of their era, she had always felt that, regardless of how dark the world seemed, ultimate justice was still present in some unseen place. Luoji had first validated that belief, and then mercilessly shattered it, and her disappointment with him had turned to shame and then anger. Coldly, she announced the results of the meeting. Luoji nodded slowly a second time, then forced a voice through his swollen throat.
I'll leave tomorrow. I ought to be going. If I've done anything wrong, I ask for your forgiveness.
It was only 2 days later that the director learned the true meaning of his final words. In fact, Luoji had been planning on leaving that night. After seeing the neighborhood committee director off, he rose unsteadily to his feet and went into the bedroom in search of a travel bag, which he packed with a few items, including a short-handled shovel he had found in the storage room. The shovel's triangular handle poked out of the travel bag. Then he retrieved a filthy jacket from the floor, put it on, slung the bag across his back, and went out. Behind him, the room's information walls continued to flash. The hallway was empty, but at the foot of the stairs he ran into a kid, probably just home from school, who stared at Luoji with a strange and unreadable expression as he left the building. Outside, he found that it was still raining, but he didn't want to go back for an umbrella. He didn't go to his own car, because that would attract the attention of the guards. Walking along the street, he left the neighborhood without running into anyone. Then he walked through the protective forest belt outside the neighborhood, and he was in the desert, the drizzle sprinkling on his face, like the light caress of a pair of cold hands. Desert and sky were hazy in the dusk, like the blank space of a traditional painting. He imagined himself added to that blank space, like the painting that Zhuang Yan had left behind. He reached the highway, and after a few minutes was able to flag down a car carrying a family of three, who warmly welcomed him aboard. They were hibernators on their way back to the old city. The child was small and the mother young, and they were squeezed next to the father in the front seat, whispering to each other. Occasionally the child would burrow his head into his mother's bosom, and whenever this happened, the three of them burst out laughing. Luoji watched, spellbound, but he couldn't hear what they were saying because music was playing in the car. Old songs from the 20th century. He listened as he rode, and after five or six songs, including Katyusha and Kalinka, he was filled with a longing to hear Tonkaya Rybina. He had sung that song to his imaginary lover on that village stage 2 centuries ago, and later with Zhuang Yan in the Garden of Eden, on the shore of the lake that reflected the snowy peaks. Then the headlights of an oncoming car illuminated the back seat as the child was glancing backwards. He turned entirely around to stare at Luoji, then shouted,
"Hey! He looks like the wall facer!"
The child's parents turned to look at him, and Luoji had to admit that he was. Just then, Tonkaya Rybina started playing. The car stopped.
"Get out!" the child's father said coldly, as mother and child watched him with expressions as chilly as the autumn rain outside. Luoji didn't move. He wanted to listen to the song.
"Please get out," the man said, and Luoji could read the words in their eyes.
"Not being able to save the world isn't your fault, but giving the world hope only to shatter it again is an unforgivable sin." So he had to get out of the car. His travel bag was tossed out after him. As the car drove off, he ran after it for a few steps in the hope of being able to listen to a little more of Tonkaya Rybina. But the song disappeared into the cold, rainy night. By now he was at the edge of the old city. The old high-rises of the past were visible in the distance, standing black in the rainy night, each building's few scattered lights looking like lonely eyes. He came across a bus stop and sat shielded from the rain for nearly an hour before a driverless public bus finally arrived that was headed in the direction he wanted to go. It was mostly empty, and the 6 or 7 people who were seated there looked like hibernators from the old city. No one on the bus spoke, just sat silently in the gloom of this autumn night. The journey passed smoothly until a little over an hour later, when someone else recognized him, and then everyone on the bus unanimously asked him to leave. He argued that he had paid the credits to buy a ticket,
so surely he had the right to a seat. But a gray-haired old man took out 2 cash coins, rarely seen these days, and tossed them at him. So in the end, he was forced off the bus. As the bus started up, someone stuck their head out the window to ask,
"Wallfacer, what are you doing with that shovel?"
"I'm digging my own grave," Luoji said, to a burst of laughter from the bus. No one knew that he was telling the truth. The rain was still coming down. There wouldn't be any more cars now, but fortunately, he wasn't too far from his destination. He shouldered his backpack and headed off. After walking for about half an hour, he turned off the highway and onto a path. It got much darker away from the road lamps, so he took a flashlight out of his bag to illuminate the ground under his feet. The path grew more difficult, and his sodden shoes squished on the ground. He slipped time and again into the mud, which covered his body, and he had to resort to using the shovel from his bag as a walking stick. All he could see ahead of him was fog and rain, but he knew that he was walking in the right general direction. After walking another hour through the rainy night, he reached the cemetery. Half of it was buried beneath the sand, while the half on slightly higher ground was still exposed. He used the flashlight to search the rows of headstones, ignoring the imposing monuments, and only looking at the inscriptions on the smaller stones. Rainwater on the stones reflected the light like flashing eyes. He noticed that all of the headstones had been erected in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Those people were fortunate. In their last moments, they must have believed that the world they lived in would exist forever. He didn't have much hope that he would find the headstone he was looking for, but as it turned out, he found it quickly. The odd thing was, despite the passage of 2 centuries, he recognized it without even looking at the inscription. Maybe it was the wash of the rain, but the headstone showed no traces of time. The inscription, "Grave of Yang Dong," seemed like it had been cut yesterday. Ye Wenjie's grave sat beside her daughter's, the 2 tombstones identical apart from the inscription. Ye Wenjie's bore only her name and the dates of her birth and death, reminding him of the small tablet at the ruins of Red Coast Base, a memorial for the forgotten. The 2 headstones stood silently in the night rain, as if they'd been waiting for Luoji's arrival. He felt tired, so he sat down next to Ye Wenjie's grave, but he soon began to shiver from the rain's chill. Grasping the shovel, he stood up, and next to the graves of mother and daughter, began digging his own. At first, digging into the wet ground required little effort, but as he got farther down, the earth turned hard and was littered with stones, which made him feel like he was digging into the mountain itself. He at once felt both the power and the powerlessness of time. Maybe only a thin layer of sand had been deposited over the course of 2 centuries, but the long geologic age, when humans were not present, had produced the mountain that now housed these graves. He dug with great effort, resting frequently, and the night slipped away unnoticed. Sometime after midnight, the rain stopped, and then the clouds parted to reveal some of the starry sky. These were the brightest stars that Luoji had seen since arriving in this age. On that evening 210 years ago, he and Ye Wenjie had stood facing the same stars. Now he saw only the stars and the headstones, the 2 greatest symbols of eternity. Finally, he ran out of stamina and couldn't dig any more. Looking at the pit he had dug, he saw that it was a little shallow for a grave, but it would have to do. Doing this was nothing more than a reminder to others that he wished to be buried on this spot anyway. His most likely resting place would be at the crematorium, where he would be burnt to ashes and then discarded in some unknown place. But it didn't really matter. It was highly likely that shortly after his death,
His remains would join the world in an even grander fire and be reduced to individual atoms. Resting against Ye Wenjie's headstone, he quickly dropped off to sleep. Perhaps it was because of the cold, but he once again dreamed of the snowy field. On it, he saw Zhuang Yan holding Xia Xia, her scarf like a flame. She and the child were calling soundlessly to him. He shouted back desperately for them to leave this place, because the droplet would strike right here. But his vocal cords produced no sound. It was like the entire world had gone mute, and everything stayed absolutely silent. But Zhuang Yan seemed to understand what he meant, and walked far across the snowy field holding the child, leaving a string of footprints in the snow, like a faint ink mark on a traditional painting. The snow was blank, and the ink mark was all that revealed the land, revealed the existence of the world. The impending destruction was all-encompassing, but it was a destruction that had nothing to do with the droplet. Once more, Luoji's heart tore painfully, and his hands clutched at the air in vain. But in the blankness of the snowy field, there was only Zhuang Yan's distant form, now a small black dot. He looked about him, hoping to find anything else that was real in the blank world. As it turned out, he found it. Two black tombstones, standing side by side on the snowy ground. At first, they were eye-catching in the snow, but then their surface began to change. They turned to mirrors that recalled the finish of the droplet, and their inscriptions disappeared. He bent down toward one of them, wanting to look at himself in the mirror, but what he saw in the mirror wasn't a reflection. The snowy field in the mirror did not have the figure of Zhuang Yan, just a line of faint footprints in the snow. He whipped his head around and saw that the snowy field outside the mirror was just a blank expanse. The footprints had disappeared. When he turned back to the mirrors, they reflected the blank world and were practically invisible themselves. But his hand could still feel their cold, smooth surface. He awoke when it was just daybreak. The graveyard was clearer in the first light of dawn, and from his prone vantage point, the surrounding headstones made him feel like he was in a prehistoric Stonehenge. He had a high fever, and his body's violent trembling sent his teeth chattering. His body seemed like a wick that had burnt dry and was consuming itself. He knew that the time had come. Leaning against Ye Wenjie's headstone, he tried to stand up. But then a small, moving black dot caught his attention. Ants ought to be fairly rare during this season, but it was indeed an ant crawling on the stone. Like its fellow ant 2 centuries before, it was attracted by the inscription and devoted itself to exploring the mysterious crisscrossing trenches. Luoji's heart experienced a last spasm of pain as he watched it, this time for all life on Earth.
"If I've done anything wrong, I'm sorry," he said to the ant.
He stood up with difficulty, trembling weakly. He had to support himself on the headstone to be able to stand. Reaching out a hand, he straightened his soaked, mud-covered clothing and wild hair, then groped in his jacket pocket for a metal tube, a fully charged pistol. Then, facing the dawn in the east, he began a final showdown between the civilization of Earth and the civilization of Tri-Solaris.
"I am speaking to Tri-Solaris," Luoji said.
His voice wasn't loud. He thought about repeating himself, but he knew that they could hear him. Nothing changed. The headstones stood quietly in the stillness of the dawn. Puddles on the ground reflected the brightening sky like countless mirrors, giving the illusion that the earth was a mirrored sphere, with the ground and the world just a thin layer on top. The rain's erosion had exposed small pieces of the sphere's smooth surface. It was a world that had not awakened yet, and didn't know that it was now a chip placed on a cosmic gambling table. Luoji raised his left hand, revealing an object on his wrist the size of a watch.
This is a vital signs monitor linked through a transmitter to a cradle system. You remember Wallfacer Ray Diaz from 2 centuries ago, so you certainly know about cradle systems. The signal sent from this monitor travels the links of the cradle system to the Snow Project's 3,614 bombs deployed in solar orbit. The signal is sent once every second to maintain the bombs in a non-triggered state. If I die, the system's maintenance signal will vanish, and all of the bombs will detonate, turning the oil film surrounding the bombs into 3,614 interstellar dust clouds ringing the sun. From a distance, the sun's visible light and other high-frequency bands will appear to flicker through the dust cloud coverage. The position of every bomb has been precisely arranged in solar orbit, so that this flickering will generate a signal transmitting 3 simple images of the sort I sent out 2 centuries ago. Each image an arrangement of 30 points, with one labeled, for composition into a 3-dimensional coordinate diagram. But, unlike last time, the position will contain the position of Tri-Solaris relative to its surrounding 29 stars. The sun will be a galactic lighthouse casting that spell. In the process, of course, also exposing the position of the sun and Earth. To receive the entire transmission at any single point in the galaxy will take more than a year. But there ought to be more than a few civilizations that have the technology to observe the sun from multiple vantage points. If that's the case, they may only need a few days or even a few hours to obtain all the information they need. As daylight brightened, the stars went out one by one, like the gradual shutting of innumerable eyes, even as the morning sky slowly opened in the east, like a single giant eye. The ant continued its climb, threading the maze of Ye Wenjie's name on her gravestone. Its species had been living on the earth 100 million years before the emergence of this gambler, who now leaned on the stone. Even though it had no care for what was now happening, it held a stake in the world. Luoji left the gravestones and stood beside the pit he had dug for himself. He placed the tip of the pistol to his heart and said, "Now, I'm going to stop the beating of my heart. By doing so, I will be committing the greatest crime in the history of our 2 worlds. I express my deepest apologies to our 2 civilizations for the crime that I commit, but I have no regrets, because this is the only option. I know the Sofons are nearby, but you have ignored humanity's call. Silence is the greatest form of contempt, and we have put up with this contempt for 2 centuries. Now, if you wish, you can continue to remain silent. I will give you 30 seconds. He marked time according to his pulse, counting 2 beats to a second, since his heart was beating so rapidly. But in his heightened anxiety, he started off wrong and had to begin again. So he wasn't certain how much time had passed by the time the Sofons appeared. Probably less than 10 seconds in objective time, but subjectively, it took a lifetime. He saw the world before his eyes split into 4 parts. One part made up of the real world that surrounded him. The other 3, deformed images in 3 spheres that appeared suddenly overhead, whose mirror surfaces were exactly like the gravestones he had seen in his last dream. He didn't know which of the Sofon's dimensional unfoldings this was, but the 3 spheres were big enough to cover half the sky above him, blocking out the brightening light in the east.
In the sphere's reflection of the western sky, he could see a few lingering stars, and the bottom of the spheres reflected a deformed graveyard and his own image. What he most wanted to know was why there were three of them. His first thought was that they symbolized Trisolaris, just like the work of art that Ye Wenjie had seen at the final ETO gathering. But looking at what the spheres reflected, an uncommonly clear, albeit deformed, picture of reality, he had the sense that they were entrances to three parallel worlds, implying three possible choices. But what he saw next negated this notion, because the three spheres flashed the same word.
"Stop. Can I discuss terms?" Luoji asked, looking up at the three spheres.
"First, put down the gun, and then we can discuss terms." The words displayed simultaneously on the spheres in letters that glowed a striking red. He saw no deformation in the line of text. It was straight, and seemed as if it was both on the surface of and within the spheres. He reminded himself that he was looking at a projection of higher-dimensional space into a three-dimensional world.
"This is not a negotiation. These are my demands, if I am to go on living. All I wish to know is whether or not you accept."
"State your demands."
"Have the droplet, or rather the probe, cease its transmissions toward the sun."
"It has been done as you ask." The sphere's answer was faster than he anticipated. He had no way to verify it at the moment, but he sensed subtle changes in his surroundings. Of course, this could be an illusion, since humans don't sense electromagnetic radiation.
"Have the nine droplets en route to the solar system change course immediately and fly away."
This time, the answer from the three spheres was delayed by a few seconds.
"It has been done as you ask." "Please give humanity the means to verify this."
"The nine probes will emit visible light. Your Ringye Fitzroy telescope will be able to detect them."
This was still impossible for him to verify, but he believed Trisolaris. "The final condition. The Trisolaran fleet may not cross the Oort cloud."
"The fleet is now under propulsion power for maximum deceleration. It is impossible for it to bring its speed relative to the sun to zero before reaching the Oort cloud."
"Then, like the droplet group, set a course away from the solar system.
Changing course in any direction is death. This will cause the fleet to fly by the solar system and into the desolation of space. The fleet's life support system will not last long enough to return to Trisolaris or search for another viable star system."
"Death isn't a certainty. Perhaps human or Trisolaran ships can catch up and rescue them."
"This will require a command from the High Council."
"If changing course is a lengthy process, get started on it now. That will give me and all the other lives a chance to live on."
The period of silence lasted for 3 minutes. Then, "The fleet will begin to change course in 10 Earth minutes. 2 years from now, human space observation systems will be able to observe the change of heading."
"Good," Luoji said, as he removed the pistol from his chest.
With his other hand, he leaned on the gravestone, trying not to fall.
"Were you already aware that the universe is a dark forest?"
"Yes. We knew about it long ago. What's strange is that you only realized it so late. Your state of health concerns us. This won't unintentionally interrupt the cradle system's maintenance signal, will it?"
"No. This device is far more advanced than Ray Diaz's. So long as I am alive, the signal won't be interrupted."
"You really should sit down. That will help with your situation."
"Thank you."
Luoji said, and he sat down against the headstone.
Don't worry. I'm not going to die.
We are in contact with the highest levels of the two internationals. Do you need us to call you an ambulance?
He smiled and shook his head.
No, I'm not a savior. I just want to leave here like an ordinary person and go home. I'll rest for a bit, and then be on my way.
Two of the three spheres disappeared. The text on the one that remained, which no longer glowed, now seemed dim and dreary. In the end, strategy was where we failed. Luoji nodded. Blocking the sun with dust clouds to send an interstellar message wasn't my invention. 20th-century astronomers had already proposed the idea. And you actually had multiple chances to see through me. During the duration of the Snow Project, for example, I was always concerned with the precise placement of the bombs in solar orbit.
You spent 2 whole months in the control room, remotely controlling the ion engines to make fine adjustments to their positioning. We didn't care about that at the time, because we thought you were just using the meaningless task as a way to escape reality. We never imagined what the distance between the bombs really meant.
Another chance was when I consulted a group of physicists with questions about SOFON unfoldings in space. If the ETO was still around, they would have already seen through me.
Yes. Abandoning them was a mistake.
Also, I requested that the Snow Project build this peculiar cradle trigger system.
That did remind us of Ray Diaz, but we did not pursue those thoughts. 2 centuries ago, Ray Diaz was not a threat to us, nor were the other two wallfacers. We transferred our contempt for them onto you.
Your contempt for them was unfair. Those 3 wallfacers were great strategists. They saw clearly the inevitable fact of humanity's defeat in the Doomsday Battle.
Perhaps we can begin negotiations.
That's not my affair,
Luoji said, and let out a long sigh. He felt as relaxed and as comfortable as if he had just been born.
Yes, you've fulfilled the Wallfacer mission, but you've got to have some suggestions.
Humanity's negotiators will no doubt first propose that you help us build a better signal transmission system, so that we'll have the ability to transmit a spell into space at any time. Even though the droplet has lifted its seal on the sun, the present system is too primitive.
We can help build a neutrino transmission system.
They may, as far as I understand things, be more inclined toward gravitational waves. After the SOFONs arrived, this was the area in which human physics progressed furthest. Of course, they'll need a system whose principles they can understand.
The antennas for gravitational waves are immense.
That's between you and them.
It's strange. Right now, I don't feel like a member of the human race. My greatest desire is to be rid of it all as soon as possible.
Next, they'll ask us to lift the SOFON block and teach science and technology across the board.
This is important to you as well. The technology of Tri-Solaris has developed at a constant speed, and 2 centuries later, you still haven't sent a faster follow-up fleet. In order to rescue the diverted Tri-Solaran fleet, you'll have to rely on the future of humanity.
I must go. Are you really able to go back on your own? The survival of 2 civilizations hinges on your life.
No problem. I feel much better now. After I go back, I'll immediately hand over the cradle system, and then I'll have no more to do with all of this.
Finally, I'd like to say thank you.
Why?
Because you let me live.
Or, if you think about it a different way, you let us both live.
The sphere vanished,
returning to its 11-dimensional microscopic state. A corner of the sun was peeking out in the east, casting gold across a world that had just survived destruction. Luoji slowly stood up. After taking a last look at the gravestones of Ye Wenjie and Yang Dong, he stumbled slowly back the way he came. The ant had reached the summit of the headstone and proudly waved its feelers at the rising sun. Out of all life on Earth, it was the only witness to what had just taken place. 5 years later, Luoji and his family could see the gravitational wave antenna in the distance, but it was still another half-hour drive away. Only when they arrived did they get a real sense of its enormous size. The antenna, a horizontal cylinder 1.5 kilometers long and 50 meters in diameter, was entirely suspended about 2 meters off the ground. Its surface was mirror smooth, half of it reflecting the sky and half the northern China plain. It reminded people of a few things: the giant pendulums of the three-body world, the Sofon's lower-dimensional unfoldings, and the droplet. The mirrored object reflected a trisolaran concept that humanity was still trying to figure out. In the words of a well-known trisolaran saying, "Hiding the self through a faithful mapping of the universe is the only path into eternity." The antenna was surrounded by a big green meadow that formed a small oasis in the desert of northern China. But this meadow had not been specially planted. Once the gravitational wave system had been completed, it began sending continuous unmodulated emissions that were indistinguishable from the gravitational waves emitted from supernovae, neutron stars, or black holes. The density of the gravitational beam had a peculiar effect in the atmosphere. Water vapor collected above it, so that it frequently rained in the antenna's vicinity. At times, the rain only fell within a radius of 3 or 4 kilometers, and a small circular rain cloud would hang in the air above the antenna like a giant flying saucer, leaving the brilliant sunshine in the surrounding area visible through the rain. And so this area grew lush with wild vegetation. But today, Luoji and his family did not witness that spectacle. Instead, they saw white clouds gather over the antenna, only to dissipate when the wind blew them away from the beam. Yet new clouds were continually forming, making the round patch of sky seem like a time wormhole to some other cloud universe. Xia Xia said that it looked like the white hair of a giant old man. As the child ran about on the grass, Luoji and Zhuang Yan followed behind until they reached the antenna. The first two gravitational wave systems were built in Europe and North America and employed magnetic levitation that suspended them a few centimeters from the base. But this antenna used anti-gravity and could have been raised up into space if so desired. The three of them stood on the grass beneath the antenna, looking up at the huge cylinder curling up over their heads like the sky. Its large radius gave the bottom a low curvature, which meant there was no distortion in the reflected image. The setting sun now shone beneath the antenna, and in the reflection, Luoji could see Zhuang Yan's long hair and white dress fluttering in the golden sunlight like an angel looking down from the sky. He lifted up the child, and she touched the antenna's smooth surface, pressing hard in one direction.
"Can I make it turn?"
"If you push long enough, you can,"
Zhuang Yan said. Then, looking at Luoji with a smile, asked,
"Right?"
He nodded at her. With enough time, she could move the earth. As had occurred so many times before, their eyes met and intertwined, a continuation of that gaze they had held in front of the Mona Lisa's smile 2 centuries before. They had discovered that the language of the eyes that Zhuang Yan had dreamed up was now a reality. Or maybe loving humans had always possessed this language.
When they looked at each other, a richness of meaning poured from their eyes, just as the clouds poured from the cloud well created by the gravitational beam, endless and unceasing. But it wasn't a language of this world. It constructed a world that gave it meaning, and only in that rosy world did the words of the language find their corresponding reference. Everyone in that world was God. All had the ability to instantaneously count and remember every grain of sand in the desert. All were able to string together stars into a crystal necklace to hang around a lover's neck. Is this love? The lines were displayed on a lower dimensional unfolding of a sophon that appeared abruptly beside them. The mirrored sphere seemed like a droplet that had fallen off of some melted area on the cylinder above them. Luoji knew few Trisolarans, and didn't know who it was who was speaking to them, or whether this one was on Trisolaris, or on the fleet that was growing increasingly distant from the solar system. Probably. Luoji nodded with a smile. Dr. Luo, I have come in protest.
Why?
Because in last night's speech, you said that humanity had been so late to realize the dark forest nature of the universe, not because your immature state of cultural evolution caused a lack of awareness of the universe, but because humanity has love.
Isn't that correct?
It's correct, though the word love is a little vague in the context of scientific discourse. But what you said next was incorrect. You said that humanity is probably the only species in the universe to have love, and it's this notion that supported you through the most difficult period of your Wallfacer mission.
That's only an expression, of course. Just a non-rigorous analogy.
I know that at least Trisolaris has love, but because it was not conducive to the civilization's overall survival, it was suppressed when it had only just germinated. Yet the seed possesses a stubborn vitality and will still grow in certain individuals.
May I ask who you are?
We've never met. I was the operator who transmitted the warning to Earth 2.5 centuries ago.
My God! And you're still alive?
Zhuang Yan exclaimed. I won't be for much longer. I've been in a dehydrated state, but over the long years, even a dehydrated body will age. However, I have seen the future I hoped to see, and for this, I am happy.
Please accept our respects, Luoji said.
I only wish to discuss with you one possibility. Perhaps seeds of love are present in other places in the universe. We ought to encourage them to sprout and grow.
That's a goal worth taking risks for.
Yes, we can take risks.
I have a dream that one day, brilliant sunlight will illuminate the dark forest. The sun was setting. Now only its tip was exposed beyond the distant mountains, as if the mountaintop was inset with a dazzling gemstone. Like the grass, the child running in the distance was bathed in the golden sunset.
The sun will set soon. Isn't your child afraid?
Of course she's not afraid. She knows that the sun will rise again tomorrow.
This is PJ Oakland. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Dark Forest by Zixin Liu. This program was produced by John Marshall Media. Text copyright 2008 by Zixin Liu. English translation copyright 2015 by China Educational Publications Import and Export Corp. Ltd. Production copyright 2015 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.